Welcome to the Ozoza Lifestyle Crucial Conversations podcast. We are honored to have with us today Adekunle Nodash Adeyugbi with us, who is a multi-award-winning filmmaker with years of experience producing world-class content in different formats for diverse clients across various platforms. He's the CEO of Something Unusual Studios, a one-stop concept transmissions film production company. He's also the team leader of the Elite Film Team, the most internationally compliant Nigerian film crew, a group of professionals who provide technical support to the most ambitious film producers whilst adhering to international best practices. Adekunle Adeyugbi is a writer, director, and producer for the critically acclaimed multiple award-winning film, The Delivery Boy, which has screened in film festivals in over four continents and has become the classic example of the new phase of Nigerian filmmaking. It was recently announced that The Delivery Boy trended on the Netflix top 10 list in over 20 countries globally upon release. Adekunle has been invited on several international panels by organizations like the Cannes Film Festival, the American State Department, et cetera, to discuss the future of African filmmaking, and his message is always the same. There is a new wave of Nigerian filmmakers who are committed to making artistic, entertaining, and globally marketable African films. And whatever we have done so far, it's just the appetizer. The main course is coming. Welcome, Adekunle.
Thank you.
Thank
Good
you
to be
so
here.
much for being with us today.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So you've created this directed, produced, written this amazing film, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Essentially about two characters, Amir and Nkem. And for me, it's really getting to the roots of radicalization, the roots of people being forced into prostitution, and social problems that we have essentially. But instead of looking at it as, oh, this is just how this person is, that's the kind of thing they like to do. Oh yes, that's how people are from that part of the country, that's what they do. As opposed to looking at it so superficially, which I think quite often people do, the majority does, and quite often the media doesn't really delve deeper into the root causes and the conditions of those. This is something that you are addressing in your film. So I would like to ask you, after having given a little summary of the film, why did you decide to write a film about Amir and Kem in this particular situation?
Yeah, so there, as with every work of art, right, there are a bunch of reasons why I chose that particular story at that time. One was two major reasons. One of them was, we're at this was, I made this film in 20, I wrote it in 2014, made it in 2015, 2016. And it was really at that point where we're all trying to come to grasp or come to terms with the fact that we have Nigerians who are terrorists, you understand? And I wasn't satisfied with the explanations I got from the media. These people are just crazy, these people are just, it just didn't add up, So I came up with my own theory and said, what could possibly make people, what could drive people to these extremes? Do you understand? And if you follow the trajectory of the story, you see that, yes, there's a guy who had been radicalized. But the way the story ended shows that people can be driven to the extreme without religion. You understand? I don't want to give people who haven't seen it. I don't want to give up, the ending of it. So that's one story. I was trying to understand things I was seeing in my society, and I just needed to come up with something. Do you understand? And share that idea with people, and hopefully it would make people think about it, and then maybe share their own ideas too. Let us have these debates. Let us have these conversations, and see what comes. The other side of, yeah, the other reason, other major reason was about the film industry, right? At that point, everybody was saying it was all comedy, comedy. I love comedies, by the way, but I just feel that as a, I watch all kinds of films, and I think there are a lot of people like myself, So
Absolutely.
at that point, I just wanted to make something, I wanted to make the kind of film I would enjoy watching. You understand? I wanted to create characters that were not, they were just not one-dimensional. You understand? People are complicated. I wanted to create that. I wanted people to see that Nigerian characters don't have to be, oh, that funny man, that wicked stepmother. That's good, but there are layers to this thing. She's not just wicked. There are deeper reasons, you understand? So it's a combination of those factors, right? That's made the choice to make that particular film.
I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, there's obviously there's quite a few things I want to ask, but I'm wondering why people don't think to themselves, this didn't happen before, why is it happening now? You know, it's not like we've always lived in a world where, but they just think, ah, oh, this thing is happening, or is those people, you know, there's such an easy solution. What is that? Where is that coming from?
I think, unfortunately, I think it's because the human mind is very efficient, right? Human beings, the human mind looks for the easiest way to solve every problem. In some cases, that is good. I mean, if a lion jumped into your room right now, you would want your mind to find the easiest way to get out. So
yes, very true. You don't want to start philosophizing in that situation.
Yes, exactly.
Not a good idea.
Yes. But the downside is when complicated problems come up, we tend to look for the easiest solution, the one that's easy. And sometimes those easy solutions are not solutions. They are not right. They're not even based on the truth.
Yes.
So I think that is why we go for, you know, the single narrative, whatever works, whatever satisfies our curiosity, whatever makes us feel good at this point we take it.
Yes, yes. I mean, can you talk to us a little bit about the synergy between the two main characters, that's Inkem and Amir? The synergy between them, what is the synergy?
I think that's an interesting question because for me, it's one of my, you know, every artist, you have this little secret you hide in your stories.
Yes.
And for me, they are the same person, right, in my mind. When I was creating the characters, it was really the same person in two different places.
Right.
I was literally just showing how anyone can become this extreme being, given the right circumstances. And you can see the parallels between their, you know, their stories. Even though they are from different parts of the country, they don't even necessarily speak the same language. They, you know, they couldn't be further apart.
Yeah.
They are the same. And within that, I hope is a lesson to all of us that we're all the same, man. You know?
Absolutely.
That brilliant person you see could be you, and that terrible person you see could be you. And if we can understand that, maybe we will have a little more empathy.
Yes.
Maybe we would try to understand people better. You understand what I mean?
If we
thought about it like this, if we were just like me.
Yes, absolutely. That. So really bringing people that are common humanity, and the fact that we're all in the human condition, we essentially all have the same base template, but the conditions and the nurturing, then actually, yes, there's some individual personality traits, but actually I think those are quite minimal compared to the impact of nurturing and the social conditions you find yourself in. Which then, and there've been scientific experiments done on this, where people put in certain situations actually evolve in a different way, even if they were genetically inclined to do a different thing because of their conditions. That, you know, overpowers that. So I think that's a really strong, and it's a very good way you presented it actually, because it's food for thought. Because we then it leads us to start thinking, oh wow, this is. I mean, there's a lot of social issues that it brings to the fore as to why were they in this situation in the first place. You know, one of the questions I had to myself, and I thought, you know, having access to the film director, the script writer, I could ask him directly. What, you know, Amir was in a trance due to his programming and, you know, what he found himself into and, you know, being radicalized and having a mentor. I want to actually talk to you about what triggered his awakening, because he woke up from this programming, which was obviously negative. It took him on a negative trajectory. Like so many people who find themselves in that under a Machiavellian or, you know, a very, very, you know, an evil mentor who says, you know, you can do these bad things. And because the person has nurtured them from childhood, they actually just listen because, you know, that's all they know, you know, and they want to please because in a sense that person is their savior. So there's all these other issues coming, you know, aspects to nurturing where, you know, how you're treated in your childhood, who rescues you, your self-esteem, all these issues. What triggered his awakening? Because not everybody wakes up, right? Or does everybody wake up, but they don't do anything about it? I mean, this is an interesting.
Yeah. So I like the way you see it. It's quite interesting. It's different from the way I see it, though. But I find it quite fascinating. For me, I don't think it was in a trance, but I agree that it was programmed. But all of us are programmed.
Yeah.
We are habitual creatures, are we not?
Yes.
So we think the same way. We run the same programs over and over again until new information comes in.
Yeah.
You know, because every program that we run has a foundation.
Yes.
And the minute that foundation is broken, we look for another program. So for him, the program he was running was, I've not had a father. I was raised in an orphanage.
Yeah.
Now, this is a father figure.
Yes.
Do you understand? And according to the father, what do fathers do? They guide the younger ones, right? Yeah. According to the father, this is the way to go.
Yes.
And it was towing that route. But the foundation was based on the love, in quotes, between him and the father.
Yeah.
But when that love became compromised, when he found out that, you know, he wasn't the only one.
Yes.
That removed the foundation for the programming.
Right.
And that switched.
Yeah.
And it went into another program of, this skill you've taught me, I'm going to use it to destroy you because you hurt me.
Yeah.
Do you understand? Yeah. So I think at every point in time, we know what we're doing.
Yes.
We might not be able to articulate it, but we are always aware.
Yes.
And we're doing it for a reason. And once that reason is removed, the behavior changes.
Yes.
And I think that is that speaks to how we can solve certain problems.
Yes.
Once we understand that people, I mean, my opinion, and this is subject to debate, but it's my opinion that once we really understand why people are doing what they are doing, and we accept that it makes sense.
Yes.
That they are not mad, they are not crazy. They are doing it for a reason. Once we know that reason and we shift that reason, the behavior will inevitably change. That's what I think.
Yes. I find the father, Malam Sadan, the father-child relationship interesting because it's a lesson for all people in positions of authority or whether they're parents or teachers. You know, especially when people are coming from, you know, a fragile situation, they've been abandoned, you know. There's all your children, you know, especially with ages 0 to 5, children really, there's an element that abandonment thing is the most important, is the biggest fear in their lives, you know. And so if they're rescued by somebody, one, they think that person's their savior. Two, there's a self-esteem issue going on there of like, oh, I wasn't good enough. You know, people always say things like that, but why did they leave? That's why a lot of people want to go and track down what happens in the past, because they need to know what happens, because there's a sense of, oh, I was left because of this reason. And so there's a self-esteem issue that kicks in that is now exploited by people like Malam Sadan. And then they try and please them. They try and overplease. You know, the child will try and overplease and be a yes person just to get that love that they feel they didn't have. And also the other thing that I thought about in this situation was the fact that they're kind of human. People's emotions are based on relationships. You know, and if they don't have those nurturing, stable relationships, it affects them physically, it affects them, you know, psychologically in every way. And then you start to look at them, like when the movie starts, you see that he has dead eyes. You see that Amir has dead eyes. And I've met people like this. I've worked on social programs where kids are very young, but they've been involved in night street crime and all this. And they're 11, 12, and I'm actually scared of them because their eyes are dead, and I'm like, oh my God, you know,
yes.
That's dangerous. And I said, like, this person is younger than my niece, or is younger than, what is all this? What kind of power do they have? And why are their eyes like that? And, you know, a lot of the psychologists say things like, once people have experienced too much pain, the brain shuts down their emotions so that they're able to handle life.
Yeah, the brain is efficient. Yeah,
it's efficient. It's protecting them. And as a result of that, they shut down to human suffering. So I'm thinking, because I always wonder to myself, why, you know, they're doing Madame Salan's orders, but they're inflicting suffering on other people. Can they not see that suffering? Can they not say, why would I? You know, but they've been numbed to it in order to cope with their own personal suffering.
Yeah, I think the other side to that story is, I mean, I agree with you completely. I think another angle to it is so the way I see it, right, I don't think the human mind is capable of processing right and wrong by itself.
Right.
Those terms are defined. Do you understand?
Yes.
So if somebody came and said, for a lot of people, you take soda And they used to celebrate, you know, when you have a birthday, you take soda, you take cake. As you grow older, they're like, oh, these things are wrong. Now you don't want to take them anymore.
Yeah.
So were they always wrong, or they became wrong, you know, at some point?
Yeah.
Same thing. We see maybe an extremist or an armed robber or somebody kill somebody. Now that is wrong.
Yeah.
But if we're being attacked and our soldiers kill the enemies,
yeah,
you know, for a lot of people, when the US was attacking Afghanistan and the Middle East and stuff, people were celebrating it, but it's still killing now, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think it's horrific. I have an issue with foreign policy, but you know, yeah, no, well, I hear the majority things, okay, that's validated, but it's still the same thing, yes.
It's the same thing. You understand?
Yeah.
And if you look at even in our own little lives, you will see that the concept of right and wrong is very subjective, even though we seem to tell ourselves it isn't. So I feel that for these boys, and in some cases girls, who are in these situations, right and wrong has been defined for them.
Right.
And all of us, let's not kid ourselves, all of us are numb to certain things. For example, they talk about global warming.
Yeah.
I still have a car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
I'm numb to that.
Yeah.
Somebody else would be like, are you crazy? Don't you see what you're doing? I'd be like, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
So I think at the end of the day, it's we're all the same, right? We're for us to get by, for us to make progress as we've defined it at this point in our existence as a race, as a, you know, as human race.
Yes.
We've conditioned ourselves to be numb to certain things, to move in certain directions. Mm-hmm. In Lagos, for example, people get into traffic from 6 a.m. just so they can get to work by 8.
Mm-hmm.
Some people leave their homes at 5. Now, is that normal?
No, absolutely not.
But we're numb to it.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, you're in traffic, you're playing music, you're dancing. What are you dancing to? You know.
Yes.
But we've decided it's a price we can pay. Even though everything, every study has shown this is dangerous, we still do it.
But is there an alternative for those people? You know, if we don't have an alternative, then, you know, is there an alternative
to be
in traffic for 2 hours in traffic? Is there an alternative job nearby? Have we created a local industry nearby?
I think what you said pretty much sums it up.
Hmm.
Of course, there are alternatives. People find alternatives all the time. People quit their jobs and they start little businesses that grow. You know, people do. There are people who are, for everybody who's in that, I mean, I've been there.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. And for everybody who's there, there's somebody who's not.
Yeah.
The thing is, we don't realize or accept that there's an alternative.
Right.
That is it. And for these, for people like Amir or even Income, they've decided that there is no alternative, but there's always one.
Yeah.
It might be difficult. It might take a paradigm shift, but it's always there.
It's always there.
You know, and if you remember the scene in The Boss?
Yes.
They spoke to that when she said, I'm trying to raise money by doing what I do. And they said, that woman needs money too, but she's not doing what you do. See, there's always an alternative.
Yeah, there's a choice. I hear you, and I was thinking about this a lot when I thought, okay, but do they have a choice? When you've been programmed from your, you know, primary years, not so much in camp, because I think she fell into the exploitation and abuse a little when she was a little bit older. But someone like, you know, between the ages of 4, 5, 6, you know, someone that goes into that abusive situation, the choices are not so easy. I mean, it's much harder. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm just being honest. You know,
yes,
very challenging.
It is.
You know, so this is where I was like, you know, it's tough. Because I said, yeah, you know, Nkem could be doing something else to raise money. She's chosen this. This is for me and also a reflection of her own self-esteem issues. I'm not good enough, so my body doesn't mean anything. This almost self-punishment that I will sell it to make money. You know, it's a reflection of almost a self-hate because of what you've experienced.
Yes.
You know, it's a symptom. And on that note, I am going to show a clip.
Of course you know who I am. Yes, I be one of them. But no, I no be like them. What does that matter to you? No. For your mind, I be butcher, kidnapper, murderer. In fact, na me be the devil. And you think say you know me. But what do you really know? Do you know my mother? Do you know my brothers, my sisters, how I take free chair, or you think, say, I be one mumu we no get any origin or dreams? If I tell you my story, you go listen. You might think you know me, but what if you're wrong? What if my story go move you past anything where you don't ever see? And what if it go show you that truth where they always run away from? That after all said and done, you are just like me.
Wanda ya fara yana cikin Qur'ani
amma Qur'anin ya ce mu zama lafiya da su amma kuma malam Sadan a muke ganin dama ki ga mun akan Qur'ani tafin na wani ba na ku mu bari sai barsan karshen malam Sadan.
Okay, wow, that's powerful stuff, huh? So things that came to mind. One, there's a disdain coming from Amir and Nkem in terms of how people perceive them.
Yes.
So we hear Amir saying that, like, you know, you think who I am, you know, if you were in my position, you'd be just like me, if not worse. You know, and then Nkem mentions it, like, you know, where she's saying she has a premonition that it's gonna be a difficult day today, something's gonna happen, and you know, how people judge her and all these useless people. So can you just speak to me a little bit about their own view of society, the disdain, the fact that they know how people look at them, but they think, you don't really know who I am, you don't even know what my dreams are, my origins, you don't know how I got into this situation, so don't judge me.
Yes.
Please talk to us about that.
So that's part of the story, or that part of my thinking came from real life interactions with people who are, people who we would consider outcasts.
Right.
You understand? Everybody wants family. Yeah. Now, family doesn't mean the one you were born into.
Yeah.
You know, but we need family. You know, we like that. It's because when you're born, the first thing that comes to your mind is, what am I?
Yeah.
And then the family is the one that tells you what you are. Yeah. But when that family abandons you, especially when the world abandons you, there are two ways to deal with it. One is to say, okay, I accept it. I deserve to be abandoned. But most people behind that, they go into, how dare you abandon me? Do you understand what I'm saying? And with that comes a certain penchant for wanting to destroy the people who abandoned you. So you do not like them. You judge them because they judge you, you know. And I think it's pretty... It's just what it is. Like most people on the streets, if you said, hey, you're stupid, most likely, without even thinking, the person just says, you too, you're stupid.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So for them, I think after both of them felt let down by the world, not just the people around them, but by the world. And behind that is, how dare you? You're not better. Do you understand?
Yeah.
That's where I think comes from.
You know, that's a really good explanation. I mean, this is what it's leading me to think. I'm thinking, you know, after watching you, yes, how dare you, how dare society allow these children to be so vulnerable? It's the responsibility of communities, society, to look after them, to protect them, nurture them. The abuse is always there, you know, but you know, when you're protected, I think also the disintegration of family, communal structures, extended family structures, where if someone passes away, then there's somebody to really take them in. It's a wholesome environment. You know, so many people are brought up with their aunties, but we know that. But it's disintegrated so that somebody is left just there at the whims of people who really have no place looking after them. Or social services, this is what we're seeing, you know? One of the questions I had for you was, this is the trajectory we're on, this whole disintegration of the communal structures. What is the role, from your perspective, of the state and the community and the regulatory authorities
in this
social problem? It's a social problem.
Yes. Well, I think that a lot of times when we talk about the role of society, I like to approach it a slightly different way, even though it's still the same thing we're talking about. Because when we tell people it's your responsibility to take care of people who abandon or whatever, the response is, to say it in Pidgin, I never solve my own problem. Now your own, how will they solve? Do you understand what I'm saying? And that's really what most people think. I still have, I got problems. Why would I be thinking about yours? But I think if we made it clear that, okay, let's take away the word responsibility. If you want to be safe, it's a selfish thing to take care of the people around you. Because if you don't, they will come back. Do you understand? Anybody who's abandoned, all those things that we push into the dark, they don't die in the dark. They grow into monsters in the dark and they will come back. You know, I think once we understand that, we start, it just shifts the way we think about it. And so what is the role of society? Society, I think, creates a buffer. Now, human beings are flawed. If the family unit were infallible, everybody was perfect, maybe we could say we don't need society, but we're not perfect. You're not always there with your kids, you can't. Do you understand? Yes, so the society provides a bigger family that serves the same purpose as the smaller one. So any lapses in the smaller family, the bigger family takes care. I mean, kind of like they say in Africa that it takes a village to raise a child. And when I was growing up, any mother could deal with you. Doesn't have to be your mom. You're walking down the street, you're acting rudely, someone else's mom who you never met is going to give you a knock on the head. Do you understand? So you never feel like you're away from your family. But now, once you're away from that family unit, you're out in the wild, nobody cares. So I feel that that might be a dangerous thing. And I think as regards the government, the state, outside the society, I think it's up to the state to provide the environment to allow the society to do what it needs to do. That's what I think.
Can you give me any tangible examples? I'm thinking about, you know, when I was watching Mr. Borkas, who runs the orphanage, where...
Sorry, I can't really hear you very well.
When I was thinking about Sister Dorcas.
Yes.
Who runs the orphanage.
One of my favorite characters, yes.
Yes. So I'm thinking, okay, how was she allowed to get away with what she was allowed to get away with? You know, where are the regulatory authorities checking, you know, having people who go in there pretending to be somebody who can, you know, in a way, people just checking and monitoring directly and indirectly, knowing that there's vulnerable children here. We need to make sure nothing untoward is happening. There's human trafficking, but really having concern that this one person is in charge of all these kids. Let's make sure there's nothing going on. You know,
yes.
What do you say of situations like that? I mean, where can they play a bigger role?
I think that, I don't have all the answers, but I would say, because Sister Dorcas is one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
Because she presents, in my opinion, a valid argument. Mm. She started this place to help kids.
Yeah.
And at some point, she's got an option. I have about 50 kids to take care of.
Yeah.
These kids are going to die. They will be left on the streets. Mm. But if I could just sell one of them, I'll be able to take care of the others. Now, it's easy for all of us to say, no, she should have done the right thing. But when you're in that situation, now it's a hard thing. Because you're thinking, okay, I want to be righteous, so I'm not going to do this. But am I being righteous by letting 50 kids die? Mm. What kind of righteousness is that?
Yeah.
But if I let one go and I say, yes, maybe... On a personal level, I feel doomed, I feel bad, but at least I'm saving 49 souls.
Yeah.
It's a difficult place to be in.
It's a difficult one, but do you really think she felt she was saving 49 souls, or was she really just doing her business?
The truth is, we'll never know.
Yeah.
But from what she said and the way I picture the character, she was actually just trying to save those kids.
Right.
Do you understand? That's the character I created. I mean, but in real life, how people, we'll never know. You know, we only know what people say, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But this is the issue, isn't it, that we have in society about ethics. Because for me, the emphasis in our societies today shouldn't, yeah, literacy is important and numeracy is important, they are. But for me, it's really more about ethics. What we're seeing is a lot of people who are becoming literate and numerate and doing very well and getting a PhD, but there's ethics is out the window. So I'm seeing people who are not in a desperate situation like Sister Dorcas still doing these kinds of things.
So
she's a representation of a mentality of money at any cost. That's what she triggered in me. And I know she may not. You know, and I know it's not so black and white. I know it's not easy. I know there are circumstances, but ultimately, I think we have to have a bit more emphasis on ethics. And really, there's limits in life. And you know, ethical frameworks have to be, education and ethics has to be promoted.
I'll tell you something somebody told me sometime. She said, we're talking about morality.
Yes.
And she said, it's easier to be moral when you're not hungry.
Yeah.
Now, all of us, and this is something that has been studied over through human history.
Yeah.
Human beings are ethical, they're polite, they're nice, until you tell them that. So we say, if there's any problem anywhere, we know we have to let the kids and the older ones go first.
Yeah.
That's it. That's, you know, it's just common sense, you know? But if we were all on the Titanic and it was sinking,
yeah,
and you had access to one boat,
yeah,
are you sure you're going to wait for the older and the kids to go? Now, it's easy for all of us to say, I'm going to, but are you sure?
Yeah, no, you know, you're completely right. You know, I had a situation which is very resonant of what you're saying, where you see that it's the systems, not the people. The systems dictate what happens, you know, to an extent. There was, you know how we have power cuts in Nigeria and people are scrambling to get on local. You know, we have that situation. You just think, Niger. But then I was in a European country, which shall remain nameless, and there was a power cut, which there almost never is. And for a couple of days or a day, people really, there was just no, I think the tubes were not running. Yeah, the underground was not running. So everybody finishing work had to get on the bus. So you can imagine the crowd.
Yes.
At 5 or 6, you can imagine. So you were not only couldn't you get on the bus, each bus stop was so crowded that you say, I can't be bothered to get onto this crowd. Let me walk to the next. So everybody had been walking for ages. And then when that bus came, everybody wanted to get on that bus. And this is when I saw people behaving like they were in a, you know, I've never seen this kind of behavior before. And I was people really pushing at each other, pulling, being aggressive. And
all of a sudden, it's so shitty.
Yeah, I just said, okay, the conditions are right, then human beings, everyone's going to behave in the same way.
Yes. And I think that, yes, we can also say there might be exceptions, people who will never, but those are few.
Tiny.
The majority of us are going to act that.
Yeah.
Do you understand? So, yeah. So I feel that, which is like I said, the message I was trying to pass across with the character, Sister Dorcas, that when you are in this situation, it's tough. So maybe, and she said something. She said, is it the Indomie and Bonvita that said it to this brain that run this place? That was my hint at maybe we should have done better.
Yes.
To make sure, because all she wanted was just for these kids to be okay. What would it cost us, guys?
Yeah.
We should have given her enough power, enough to be able to say no.
Yeah.
We are willing to empower enough to say no.
Yeah.
And then tomorrow we're saying, oh my gosh, she sold kids and they became terrorists. Do we really have the right to say that?
Yeah, no, we don't. We don't. We have to, as a society, create conditions that enable people to be, you know, be balanced as they can be. You know, we need to create, we need that, but this is what I'm saying, we need to start looking at roadmaps and looking, you know, social conditions, different types of, the different sectors of society that will minimize these problems.
Yes.
Because they're social problems, right?
Yes, and that's all people are asking for. They are not saying we all want to be Dangote. No, nobody's saying that. We're just saying, can we, and this for me, I'm not blaming the government on this one. Let the government do what the government's supposed to do.
Yeah.
I'm talking about us.
Yeah.
As Africans, I mean, at least when I was growing up, and I know it was even more before I was born.
Yes.
Somebody was sick, the whole village would contribute to feed that person's kids.
Yes.
Do you understand? Somebody would say, okay, you come and start living with me. Your father is sick or your parents are ill. Come here. Yeah. I'll be training you, you know, and everybody would gather around them.
Yeah.
But if taking that, they won't say we're waiting for the king. Yeah. The king has a role, no doubt. But you don't wait for the king. You do what you do, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, but now that family is having issues. All right, bye-bye. I've got to go to work. You know, and then tomorrow we're surprised that the kids are robbing us.
Can we just zoom into this? Because this is a really key issue. So this is a reality. And you know, what has changed? Is it the economic pressure, and why has the economic pressure changed? Because in the past, people didn't have more money. It's not like, oh, they were rich before, but there wasn't the same kind of economic pressure.
Yeah.
So, and what has changed? When has it changed? So we need to look at the history of these changes and what changed to make people so be running after their job and money and hustling, because everyone's just like, no one even has time, you know, just pay those bills. What pressure on like that? My grandparents were not under that kind of pressure.
No, they were not.
They fed themselves and they had time for you and they were relaxed and they still got up and went out to work and they were farming.
Yeah,
fun. That kind of pressure?
Yeah. So I saw there was something I was reading that kind of answers that question.
Mm.
So some lady went to Tibet.
Yeah.
And she spent some time there and then she met this guy. This young guy who was, I think, was a tour guide or something, and they had a conversation, you know, over a period of time. And the guy was the most peaceful person she ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And she was asking the guy that, don't you want more?
Yeah.
I mean, don't you want Nike trainers? Don't you want the latest iPhone? And the guy's like, what is that gonna add to me?
Yeah.
And the lady was showing him pictures of the United States.
Yeah.
And we were like, why do I want to live in a concrete jungle?
Yes.
Here, I know my neighbors, the air is still pure. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Why do I want more?
Yeah.
Like, I have more. You don't have a lot. You know?
Go on holiday to places where I live to get a break.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You guys go on holidays.
Yeah.
You know, like, why do I want my home to look like yours? You run away from your home whenever you get a chance.
Yeah.
And then the lady was very thought. I mean, it really, really hit her hard. So she went back to the States. Then she came back about 6 or 7 years later.
Mm.
And gets to the same place. She meets the same guy.
Yeah.
Now the guy is, you know, dressed like a hip-hop artist. She was like, what's going on? The guy like, no, this place is crappy. I wish we had all the malls, you know.
Oh, really? Interesting.
And she was like, I don't believe this. Like, can you remember a conversation? Like, I can still remember a conversation years ago. What happened?
Yeah.
And apparently what happened was the media changed.
Mm. Wow.
That was what she realized, that the media now started showing all this cool stuff and selling it to them.
Wow.
Selling a certain look, selling a certain lifestyle. And human beings, when you keep showing people the same thing over and over again, it doesn't matter if it's true or not, or if it makes sense or not, they will believe it.
Yeah, it's true.
Doesn't matter. I mean, there's no logic to it.
Mm.
If you keep showing people the same thing, good example, you listen to a song on radio, you're like, oh, whack song. I'm not going to hear that song again. If they keep playing that song,
yeah.
You start dancing to it.
Yeah. So they if you repeat a lie often enough, it becomes a truth.
It becomes the truth.
Absolutely. So
I think that's what might have been one of the things that happened to us.
Yeah.
Our circle of influence at that point was, you know, people who thought like us.
Yeah.
And those values, if you wanted to do anything about life, you go to your grandfather, he would say the same thing your father would say, your mother, your uncle. So these ideas, these values were reinforced every day.
Yes.
Then we stopped listening to them because there was something superior.
Hmm.
So superior ideas that were imported.
Yes.
You know, we consider them superior. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Those ideas spoke a different language. They sold a different value system. Yeah. And we bought them. And here we are.
But also there was nobody to counteract those ideas, because nobody's saying we should stop technology. I mean, technology has, look what we're doing now is because of technology. Technology has its use. But it's about educating the children to be critical thinkers. You know, don't believe everything you see, you know, just creating some kind of balance. So they take advantage of the technology, but they're not consumed by it, I think.
I say, in fairness to our parents, they tried. If you think back, they tried. They tried to tell us, why are you doing this? This is not right. But it's a question of volume. So you're with your parents for 2 hours a day. The rest of the day, you're watching TV, you're seeing billboards, you're listening to the radio. So it's only a small, kind of like when I have conversations with people who are in the religious circle. And like there was a, I won't mention names, but there's a time I was, I had a very long layover at Heathrow Airport, and there was somebody in the religious circles who we flew together, we were on the same plane.
Right.
You know, somebody very popular. And we just spent about 6 hours talking.
Yeah.
And one of the things I said to him was, if you are serious about changing the society, this is not by any religion or not, just changing the society, and you are not playing in the media space, you're a joker.
Yeah.
Because whatever you preach, if you're a Christian, whatever you preach to your congregation on Sunday, maybe you preach for 1 hour.
Yeah.
Between your church and their houses, they've been assaulted by the radio, you know, telling a different set of values. They don't stand a chance.
Yeah, it's true. It's so true. It's completely true. So this is about community. So what would you say individuals and communities can do to try and see, because we're talking about, let's localize it, let's not be delegating it up to centralized powers. I mean, I think successful societies have been successful when things have been localized. And things, because life is everyday. Life is supporting the, getting your fruits from the person on the corner so they can now feed their family. Life is the localized life. That is life. So what can, you know, individuals do? What can communities do to try and redress some of these issues?
I think, I don't have all the answers, like I say, but I've made my own two cents. I think the first thing is figure out what's influencing people right now and control that influence.
Yes.
Make sure the influence is positive. No matter what you do, it will not count if what's influencing them is not sending the right message.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter. You can like a lot of people say, let's go to this community and do vocational training. Okay, but their circle of influence is saying that all you have to do is Yahoo Yahoo. By the time you leave after your 1 week, they have, you know, they have so many more weeks to be influenced to do the wrong thing. So the first thing I think is to figure out what's influencing people.
Yeah.
And get in that space.
Yes.
Do you understand?
No, that's a good piece of advice. That's solid. I mean, there's a number of NGOs I'm aware of who do kind of rehabilitation programs for people who have been, this is on the other end of the spectrum. This is, I was asking you about what we can do. And then the other end, people who have been victims of that environment, there's quite a few NGOs doing some, you know, lots of really good rehabilitation programs and helping them to talk through the issues, look back at what happened and then rebuild themselves. Which are very, you know, very commendable, actually, what some people are doing in these areas. There's one last point I want to ask, because it's been really insightful and interesting. The concept of human dignity, is that something we've lost? I mean, this is a concept it's a fact, you know, human dignity needs to be preserved, from Socrates to Plato to the Enlightenment. You know, all the big philosophers talk about the importance of preserving human dignity. And even in asking you the question of what can we do, it's an attempt to preserve human dignity in a sense, because I think we all have a right to a certain condition. Why should this person be in this condition? That could be me, that could be anybody, that could be somebody I know. Why? That's awful. So where is the sense of we need to work as a society towards human dignity? Where is that in our society?
I think that, I don't think human dignity has... I don't think it's lost, but I think the definition has evolved it shouldn't evolve, right? It should be basic, but the perception of what it is has evolved.
Yes.
So right now, if you ask the average guy on the street, especially a young person on the street, what makes you dignified? The first thing they'll say is money. So human beings always look for dignity.
Right.
But what is dignity at this point in time? Do you understand?
Yeah.
So people feel, if I'm famous, if I have money,
yes,
you know, I walk into a place, I'm recognized, that's dignity, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe, I mean, if we want to, I think we just need to do better at, because I'm a big student of psychology. I mean, I didn't study, I'm just saying, as a person. And I found that there's no amount of work we can do if we do not influence what's in here.
Yeah.
It doesn't count.
Yeah.
So maybe NGOs who really are serious, because that's something I am, even my company, we're very particular about. How do we use entertainment?
Yeah.
How do we use it? Not just entertain people, but how do we use it as a force? Yes. Do you understand? How do we deploy it and say this is what we want to do?
Yes.
Do you understand? We call ourselves architects of perception, right?
Yes, yes.
And you know, and as architects of perception, this is what we do.
Yeah.
We help people see.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're complaining about certain things, there's a structural, there are many things we need to do, but if we don't fix the mental, it doesn't count. You know that saying that if you took 100 monkeys out of the jungle and you put them into the city, come back 2 weeks later, the city would become a jungle. You know?
Yeah.
So I think that maybe it's time for us to start thinking, how did the definition of dignity change? How did it change?
Yeah.
And how do we change it back?
Yeah, it's about the definition, isn't it? It's change definition. Yes.
Yeah. And there's a whole system that we need to deploy to convince people that this is the new. You know, we can't just sit on our high horses and say, oh, these people are doing, nobody is doing bad. They're doing what they know to do, what they've been taught to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I think one. I was thinking two things. So there's people on the receiving end, like people might, like myself, who watch it, and you know, it brings up a lot of issues. And people I know who now think, okay, we can do something with NGOs we're aware of, and we can create synergies, which is wonderful, because it really, the film is powerful and that it really triggers that. Because it's something that a lot of us have been thinking about for a long time, the roots of radicalization, the roots of, you know, social, you know, disintegration, and thinking, what can one do practically? But also, I'm even thinking a lot of the rehabilitation NGOs, potentially as even part of their programs, having some screenings, it might be painful, so that you'd have one have to consult the psychologist. You know, most of them are psychologists and things. They're doing a lot of therapy. But also people seeing themselves in a way on screen. I'm really wondering what, I mean, I'm actually just throwing it out there now. It actually just came into my mind literally now. I'm wondering what kind of impact that would have if you are, somebody who's, I suppose it depends on the state of your rehabilitation, whether you're ready for it. But to see a mirror on the screen, to see this and to relate very personally to a lot of it.
I think it would be a powerful thing, and I think it would be a powerful thing. But I also think even more than that, we have to even become more conscious about creating such content that are directed towards addressing certain things, not just talking about them. Because sometimes we filmmakers, we say, "I made a film talking about a certain issue." Good, we like that, but we've got to go deeper than that now.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when you show people images with sound, even when they leave that place, stays in their subconscious. So, and that is where things start changing. Yeah. You can talk to people till tomorrow.
No.
Good luck. Yeah, but images.
Yes, because you're completely right, because the definition of human dignity, which we've just said, has been affected by those images that they've been seeing.
Yes, yes. You know, so we need to change it again.
Exactly.
But we have to be deliberate about it. And that is what I do. You know, that is what I'm really pushing for.
Yes.
I mean, so for example, we know some of the people who I really respect for doing this is the United States of America, Hollywood.
Yeah.
They have sold America. And deliberate. It's not somebody somewhere wrote. No, it is a group of people have come together and said, we're going to sell the hell out of this thing.
Yes.
To a point where you ask the average person, they can't even believe anything negative about that.
Yeah, you absolutely, know. Absolutely. No, it's very deliberate. And if you look through history, you'll see, you know, after the First and Second World Wars, there was a deliberate initiative to move away from because Germany kind of dominated the cultural space, philosophically, yes, artists for a long time. And then because of the First World War, which obviously, you know, the Second World War and their involvement in that, there was now a deliberate initiative to switch the cultural, to remove them as the cultural dominating force and to focus more on the English and American. You know, it was actually to say, you know, and they started promoting Shakespeare more. Because if you just think about it, suddenly Shakespeare was, you know, 19th century Shakespeare was not so, you know, and they promoted Shakespeare, they promoted all their own authors and this and their movies and this, and it was a deliberate policy.
Yes. And you know the funny thing is,
yeah,
Hitler, if you've studied Hitler, Hitler understood the power of the media.
Yeah.
He was a media genius.
Yeah.
And when everybody saw what he did with that,
yeah,
see what happened with when Hollywood started making noise. Right now, think about it for a second. Hollywood is the, you know, the most influential film industry in the world, you can't argue.
Yeah.
But why do we have the Cannes Film Festival, for example? The French government invests in that festival,
yeah,
because at some point everybody was trying to do stuff together and they realized, nah, we've got to have our own.
Yeah.
So you have Berlinale by the, these are heavy.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
You know, because entertainment gets here.
Yeah.
If you change what's here, what's out here will change.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, where is, just to close on this point, just so people who are watching are aware, where is Nigeria on the film festival? I'd say Nigeria, West Africa, Africa, on the whole film festival in terms of locally, our own local film festival, where are we, you know, on that? Can you enlighten us on that?
Yeah, I think there are some film festivals in Nigeria. I've been part of a few. I mean, I've screened at a few. And yeah, they're doing okay. I mean, obviously, as with everything, they're all young, but they're growing. And they're determined, you know, there are a bunch of them. I don't want to mention specific ones, but there are a bunch.
Okay.
You know. But actually, I will. Lights, Camera, Africa, Afrif. These are all festivals, you know, that there's a real time. There are a bunch of them. And they're all doing, you know, they're pushing.
Yes.
But I think that film festivals are good.
Yes.
And there's an essential place they must occupy.
Yes.
But the real power, I'll give an example. Some of the biggest film festivals in the world, one of perhaps the biggest film festival is the Cannes Film Festival.
Yes.
And that's owned by France, no?
Yes.
But they don't have the strongest influence when it comes to the society. That is from Hollywood.
Yes. Yes.
So film festivals are good for creating filmmakers, for helping people grow, for, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
But the real influence comes from the film industry.
Yes.
Do you understand? Yes. So it's like about it. The film festivals helps the filmmaker grow so that they can make content, powerful content in the industry outside the festivals.
Yes.
So people in Nigeria, I'll give you a good example. I'm not even asking Nigerians to think outside the box.
Yeah.
It's already happening. The average person, I'll give an example. We're doing a recce, location recce for a project.
Yes.
And it was a pastor that took us to the market to check it out. As we were trying to get out of the market, it was on a Sunday, so it was locked. There was a red rope that was tied across the gate.
Right.
And we're going to pass. Then the pastor said, no, let's go and pass a longer route. We're like, oh, why can't we go through here? He said, the red rope, that it's voodoo, it's jazz.
Okay.
And I said, but you're a pastor. Yes. You know, like, yes, why are you afraid of, shouldn't you be on a higher level spiritually? No matter what we said, the guy didn't pass the place. We did, but he had to go the longer route.
Yeah.
Now, I asked that pastor a question. I said, have you had any encounter with these kind of things? We're like, no. So why is he afraid of them? From the movies.
Right.
In the movies, when there's one red rope, somebody crosses in and at night it falls down and it dies. That's it.
Wow.
We are already influenced.
Yes.
Do you understand?
Yes.
The weekend stepmother, blah, blah. All of those things are sold in films and people have bought into it. We're just saying, same effect.
Yes.
Let's multiply.
Yes. So this is, I mean, so that what you're telling me now is that the Nollywood industry is very established. It is, we know, and it's very powerful. So we already have the machinery there. We already have the infrastructure there, but it's a certain narrative.
Yes. So we already have the machinery. We already have, I mean, everything can be developed, right? But we already have that power.
Do
you understand?
Yeah.
We just need to now be more deliberate about using the power.
Yes.
Do you understand? It's like having a cutlass. You can cut yourself or you can cut the grass. But say, stop cutting yourself. Turn to the grass. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes. The question I want to ask, because I know I keep asking questions and say, they keep coming. Do you think we have a captive audience for these kinds of films that are addressing real issues that are also entertaining? Also, you know, they don't have to be all serious and gritty. They can also have a lighter element. But do you think there's a captive audience for that? Because that is what a lot of independent filmmakers globally also struggle with, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the audience is there. There's no doubt. The audience is there. If you tell a story that is good, that people can relate to, that makes sense. But you have to now get the story to the audience.
Right.
That's where the problem is.
Right.
You can tell a story, but just like you can make a product.
Yeah.
There are perhaps better phones than the iPhone and all these ones somewhere in Venezuela, but they are not distributing it, so I don't care.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
So, but I think that the distribution channels obviously are already there.
Yes.
We need to improve them.
Yeah.
Do you understand? We have about 200 million people. That's a huge market for any product. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's a huge market, absolutely.
Yeah. But the filmmaker might not be the best person, because the way you think as a distributor, you don't think like an artist.
That's
sometimes we filmmakers are too artistic, too poetic.
Yeah.
You understand?
But this is my question. This you, because there's a marriage gonna be happening between the commercial distributor and the artistic, you know, filmmaker. And that there has to be somehow a meeting, there has to be some common denominators which make it viable for both sides to achieve their objectives.
Yes, I think that is the best case scenario, this marriage. And those things are already happening. There's still some struggles, but they're already happening.
Yeah.
But I think that as it happened with every industry, the oil industry, with John D. Rockefeller and all of them, somebody has to, and usually somebody from the outside, has to say, you know what, guys, you guys, this is going to be an arranged marriage. Okay, we've got to make this work. There'll be some fears, but eventually we will succeed.
Right.
You understand? We need to get, if you want to change this country or this continent, it's not about appealing to the niche market.
Right.
It's the mass market.
Right.
That's what we need to get these artistic films to. If it's to organize, to make films, or maybe have an organization that they find good films and they do local screenings around the country in villages, that's one way to do it.
Yes.
You understand? Take the film and just move around. The filmmaker won't mind.
Yes.
Do you understand? So that means the filmmaker feels, if I make my film, maybe I sell it to a couple of people, but there are these people who will also take it around. That might be one way to build it. You know, I'm sure there are other ways by more intelligent people, but that's just what I can think of.
Well, Adekunle, on that note, it's been such a pleasure. It really has been a real pleasure. And thank you very much. It's been such an insightful interview. I could go on asking questions, as you know, but we have to stop. So thank you so much. So your film, just a few things for viewers to follow up, because I know people always like to follow up after these podcasts. Your film is available on Netflix.
Yes, it is.
To watch. And in terms of your studio and production company, that's Something Unusual Studios, if they want to get in touch with you. That's right? Yes. Okay.
Yep. I'm being at Something Unusual Studios. Studios with an S. Studios. And you can find me on social. I mean, you can find anybody.
Just Google your name. Your name will be on the podcast, so they can just Google your name. You're right, and they can find more information. On that note, thank you so much, and we look forward to being in touch and speaking to you again in the future. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Bye.
Yes.